Today on the 21st, Asian Americans are often regarded as a so-called model minority, defined by markers of success and failure. We'll talk with Erin Kuei Nin, whose latest book tells true stories of Asian Americans who went to troubling lengths, including scamming the system and beyond, in order to meet expectations. The book is called Passing for Perfect, College Imposters, and Other Model Minorities. We'll also hear from a therapist who helps people deal with cultural and identity pressures, and students will talk about their experiences. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been well documented that record numbers of college students are reporting symptoms of anxiety and depression. And while that's an increasingly common experience, it's also been documented that academic pressure and stress is felt acutely among a particular group, Asian Americans. As a group, Asian Americans are often stereotyped as a model minority, and students find their experiences are defined by markers of success and failure. Under the pressure, some have reached breaking points, taking extreme measures to cope. There's the story of Asia Kim, who pretended to be a Stanford freshman, even going so far as to live in a dorm. There's also Jennifer Pan, who hired a hitman to kill her parents so they wouldn't find out she never received her high school diploma. Earlier this year, I spoke with a scholar who argues that being a model minority does not require one to believe in the myth of universal success. Her new book explores the stories of outliers and the unbelievable lengths to which they went to perform the role of perfect students. I spoke with Erin Kuei Nin, associate professor in the Department of Asian American Studies at UC Santa Barbara and author of the book Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. We also heard about the personal experiences of Raina Wu. She's studying computer science and philosophy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her mother is from Japan. Her father is Chinese-American. And later in our conversation, we'll hear from Nia Lei. He's a clinical social worker and therapist who helps people cope with pressures and questions around their culture and identity. Because our show is on tape today, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought about our conversations by emailing talk at 21stshow.org. That's talk at 21stshow.org, or you can talk with us in real time on Twitter at 21st Show. Here now is my conversation with Erin Kuei Nin and Raina Wu. So, Professor Nin, before we get into your book, I just want to talk a little bit about you. You're a Vietnamese American. You identify as Asian American. In a graphic we saw for UC Santa Barbara, you're quoted as saying, "It's like the difference between natal and chosen family." What did you mean by that?
Well, this is part of a conversation about what it is to be model minority versus Asian American. Asian American as a term historically was coined at a time to identify a kind of coalitional politics in the 60s, right? And a kind of leftist solidarity with African Americans and Native Americans, other brown people. And so to use that term correctly and its kind of true definition is to recognize that it is a fiction, but it's a fiction that is adopted to mean something. In other words, I would use Asian American in the same way that I use feminist, right? You were born a woman, but or female or cisgender, but what you adopt as a gender identity, right, or as a politics, is perhaps feminist, and that would be in gender terms mine. But so I would say that I was born Vietnamese American and raised Vietnamese American, socialized in those terms. But the identity and the kind of chosen family that I claim is Asian American.
That's so interesting because I don't know if you're familiar with the relatively new book called The Loneliest Americans by Jay Kasmin Kang. And we spoke with him on the show, and he has a little bit more, I guess you'd say, complicated view, or he sort of explores the limits of that pan-Asian American identity. And just to briefly, it's a you know, people should read the whole book or go back and listen to our conversation. But basically his argument is that, you know, there's a he draws a line between the sort of the Asian Americans who are sort of post-Hart Celler, who are more immigrants here in the wake of American imperialism, versus the mostly Japanese and Chinese Americans who have been in America for, well, more than a century and a half, 2 centuries. I wonder what you think of that. You know, he sort of says, you know, one of the few things that unites this idea of Asian Americans is the assumptions of white people.
So definitely Asian American is as an idea, did arise as a way to cohere an immigrant experience. I think, you know, both 1965 and the kind of more highly skilled labor that got recruited into the US then speaks to an identity that is not grounded in cultural specifics. When people talk about, for example, Asian culture, there is no specific Asian culture to refer to, right? But there is a general Asian American identity that has to do with immigration. And yes, racialization. So the perception, as J. Kasmin Kang would say, of white people and the kind of response to that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no there, right? And what my book actually picks up on is that there are certain experiences that, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with a Facebook group, Subtle Asian Traits, but
I'm not.
There is a, it was actually started by Asian Australians. And it part of it is meant to be very lighthearted and funny, and they share quirky things like, oh, do you save plastic bags to use as trash bags? And that is a subtle Asian trait, right? But then some of it is a lot more serious about intergenerational conflict or mental health, the kinds of things. And, you know, even though they're Asian Australians, Asian Canadians and Asian Americans often have joined this group and kind of raise their hands and say, yes, that is also me, right? So the identity speaks to people, or this kind of, there is a commonality that speaks to people and that does cohere despite its kind of original fictionality. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about this idea or stereotype of the model minority. Where does that myth come from? Can you talk a little bit about its history?
So the term was coined in 1966 by a sociologist at a time when, you know, during heightened cultural unrest and protests led by Black and Native American and Latinx groups to demand that the systems of US inequality change, right? So from locating institutional discrimination in education and law, the prison systems, and you know, even in banks and how real estate loans are given out, redlining. So all of this kind of recognition that the system itself is geared to discriminate against, you know, minority groups, right? And Asian Americans, the Japanese and Chinese that had been here for generations, and that J. Kasmin Kang talks about, were at that time very well positioned to be framed as a model minority because they had been practicing a kind of respectability politics. Right? For Japanese Americans, it came out at least partially of the internment experience and needing to kind of recuperate their Americanness. So they had, in some sense, partly embraced and been gearing up for this recognition as a model minority already. And some of the more recent historical work in Asian American studies talks about this, Ellen Wu, Madeline Chu. This is not monolithically. There are also, of course, groups within Chinese and Japanese American communities that were much more left-leaning and reacted to this coining of the model more minority, you know, to contrast the Japanese and Chinese Americans to the rebellious groups, right? And instead responded by saying, you know, no, we were actually Asian Americans. We use this term instead, and you know, referring back to that moment of coalitional politics. So you can kind of locate that moment in that moment of split. You could choose to be and to adopt and to embrace this definition of model minority, or you could choose instead to reject it and you know, identify as Asian.
Okay, so let's talk about your book, which is, again, is called Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. What led you to take you this approach to looking at, you know, these students who, you know, are imposters or scammers? They struggle to cope with their high pressures, sort of environments or lives. Why navigate this issue through outliers?
You know, I felt like these cases inherently pose such compelling questions. So when we talk about, if I were to just use the term college imposter out of the blue, I think people would tend to think of the Varsity Blues cases, for example, right? Or other cases in which somebody is committing a kind of academic fraud. So maybe they have submitted false transcripts or something to cheat their way into higher education, the college they want, right? Those cases, while unethical, are actually not terribly interesting in the sense that it's so easy to see what their motivations would be, right? But in cases like Asia and Jennifer, we have young people pretending to go to college. These are people who, in both of their cases, were not admitted to the colleges that they, you know, went through these elaborate charades day after day of feigning to attend, right? So in both their cases, they would go, they would leave the house in the morning and go to the library. Well, Jennifer lived at home, and so it was more like, you know, going to the public library. For Asia, she would leave the dorm that she was squatting in and go to the Stanford Library. And there they would spend all day, you know, pretending to, or maybe actually studying for, in Asia's case, midterms that they were not gonna take. And maybe write papers for classes that they were not enrolled in, for which they would receive no credit, no grade, right? Why do this? So these motivations, you know, as I said, these are not the actions of rational economic actors, right? And so what is driving them? I felt like these outlier cases and their tragic endings, right? Even for Asia to have been found out as she was, and I think I imagine she's changed her name because I can't find her anywhere on the internet now. I think she's ghosted us. Certainly for Jennifer, who is serving a life sentence in prison and whose mother is dead. And I mean, her family is just destroyed, right, one way or another. These are such tragic outcomes. And so these stories help both to articulate the high cost of what it is that's driving them, this model of funneling second generation kids into these very narrow requirements for success and acceptance, you know, social acceptance, not just, you know, a kind of pat on the back, but it is unacceptable if among family, among, you know, in society, you're invisible if you haven't achieved these high markers. Punishing people who do not make these really kind of, I mean, nobody, not already, but very few people can actually make the high requirements of getting into the Ivy Leagues and becoming a doctor and a lawyer, what happens to the rest. But also, you know, if you do get in, the pressure never lets up. It's not like you can just stop. So there's the high cost.
Right. The Stanford admission feels like the end goal, but once you get there, you realize, oh no, this race is going on for many more miles.
Yes, your entire life, really.
Yeah. Right? All right, we need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. We're going to bring Raina Wu into the conversation when we come back. Let me just remind listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We've been speaking with Erin Kuei-Nin, who's associate professor in the Department of Asian American Studies at UC Santa Barbara, and the author of the book Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. It explores outlier cases of students who have gone to great lengths to sort of perform the role of being perfect students. As we've been talking about, one sort of pretended to be a student at Stanford, even squatting in the dorms. Another tragically hired someone to kill her mother so that her parents wouldn't find out she never received a high school diploma. We're going to talk more about these cases and this issue more broadly when we come back. Because our show is on tape today, we're not taking calls, but you can always communicate with us in real time at 21st Show on Twitter. That's at 21st Show. Before we take a break, I also want to urge you to subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify just by searching for The 21st Show. You can also find links to our podcast from our website, 21stshow.org. And while you're there, you can catch up with recent conversations on the latest in the race for Illinois governor in the Republican primary, also who Ken Griffin is and why he's spending tens of millions of dollars to try to influence the outcome in the Republican primary. Again, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Erin Kuei-Nin, who is an associate professor in the Department of Asian American Studies at UC Santa Barbara, author of the book Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities, which looks at the stereotype of the Asian American model minority and this sort of pressure to be the perfect student, that sort of thing. And it explores that story by looking at the incredible lengths to which some students have gone to sort of meet the expectations and the pressures that they felt performing the role of perfect students. I want to bring Raina Wu into our conversation now, who's an actual student in computer science and philosophy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about if anything we've been talking about so far, how it resonates you, and just if you can speak to your own background and experience.
Yeah, something that did really resonate with me early on is when Erin mentioned Asian American identity. I think that for me, that's definitely a distinct identity from me being Japanese American or Chinese American. And growing up, I spent most of my time from kindergarten through junior year of high school in a school district where I was surrounded by Asian American students. It was, I think, majority minority. And I feel like the academic pressures at that school were very strong, and I think partially fueled by the myth, there was always this pressure to be the perfect student, to take all honors in AP classes, to get perfect grades, and to get perfect or near perfect standardized test scores. And people seem to have the mindset that, you know, it's Ivies or like these elite institutions or nothing. A lot of people look down on state schools and other public schools, and there was this constant push. And even though I felt like, even though my parents specifically told me, you know, it's okay to do what you want to do things at your own pace, I think just being in that community and having all of those social pressures really increased the academic pressure as well.
Did you see, I mean, did if you're comfortable talking about yourself, or did you have friends who sort of felt like this really took a toll on them, this idea of, you know, performing this model minority role?
Yeah, just speaking for myself, I think it did cause a lot of stress and anxiety throughout my high school experience. And when I actually moved schools, I moved to Illinois the summer before my senior year of high school. It was really shocking to see how different that school district was. It was a predominantly white school district. And then going there, I saw a lot of people that didn't feel the same academic pressures. And I think going to state schools was the norm, and not a lot of people were striving for the elite institutions as like the only option. And that change in environment, especially when I was applying to schools, was really interesting, and it was refreshing in some ways, but in other ways, it felt like, I don't know, like maybe was I like wrong to be thinking these things for so long. And like when I finally found like an Asian American community or like a few Asian American friends, I think that they actually felt the same academic pressures that I did, even in this different environment. So I think there's definitely something to that.
I was going to ask you if it made you more relaxed, or did you feel like, what is wrong with you people? Why aren't you working harder?
Part of it was, I guess, a little bit relaxing to see that, like, okay, like, there are other options. But I think part of it was, like, I don't know, I feel like the guidance counselors and, like, the College Resource Center didn't really understand where I was coming from. And they're like, oh, my goodness. Like, at my old school, it was, like, a given to be applying to, like, 10-plus schools, and that was normal. But then when I moved, they're like, if you're applying to any more than, like, 5 schools, then you seriously need to talk to us. And I was like, oh, no, like, is there – I thought this was normal. I thought this was what everyone did, yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, as you know, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign is a great school for computer science, so don't let anyone tell you otherwise. We just had a conversation earlier this week with somebody who's written a book about all the many people who founded PayPal 20 years ago who went through the U of I system. Mm-hmm. So how do you work now to maintain this, you know, sense of cultural pride and identity while facing these pressures from society and this myth we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think something that really helped me is growing up in an area where a lot of people were like me. I was never ashamed or embarrassed by my Asian American identity, and I've really been able to celebrate both Japanese and Chinese culture, specifically through food and different holidays that I celebrate with my family. And that's something that I think I can continue to carry with me. And I write for the DI and the opinion section. I think a lot of my writing does come from my Asian American identity and that pride and that aspect of who I am.
The Daily Illini. All right. So, Professor Nin, let me go back to you. So can we talk about a little more in detail about some of the stories in the book? We mentioned Asia Kim earlier. This is someone who falsely posed as a Stanford undergrad for months, even, as you said, living in the dorms or squatting in the dorms. What was driving her?
Well, like Raina. Hi, Raina. Thank you so much for that. She also grew up in a predominantly Asian American neighborhood and went to a school that was majority Asian American. And so whether or not her parents specifically applied a lot of pressure on her, I think there was a lot of community pressure, and also the school itself prided itself on being on churning out high achieving students. And so I think the norm of expectations there was there was a kind of mind meld, you know, like we hear from Raina about what one does and what is normal. And normal is actually extraordinary, right? And so while there is very little information available publicly about the specifics of what drove Asia to that decision, I think emotionally it is possible to glean a moment where, you know, she maybe didn't quite mean to do all of this, right? But maybe she said, oh yeah, I did get into Stanford, and then she couldn't take it back, you know?
Yeah, one rash decision.
Sorry, go ahead.
one rash decision, and then you're kind of you're digging. Yeah, and you keep digging.
Yeah, you're stuck, and it was a desire not to disappoint, right? Maybe a deferral of disappointment, something like that, you know. And then the next thing you know, it's 9 months later.
How did that resolve itself? How did she get found out? If that's, you know, how can you talk a little bit about? And you said she's disappeared as far as you can tell now. But
yeah. So it's incredible because, you know, day in, day out, no one suspected her because she looks the part. She's this neat and studious Asian American kid. And so nobody questioned why she had no card key going in and out of the dorms and the cafeterias. But one day, I think that the RA of the dorm that she had been staying in wanted to compile a roster or some kind of yearbook, I think, and then finally looked her up and realized that she was not registered. And that was in the morning, one spring, you know, morning, and two weeks before finals at Stanford. And then by that night, you know, 10 p.m., midnight, she was out on the street. It was past.
Wow. Okay, let me take a moment to reintroduce the conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We've been speaking with Erin Kuei-Nin, who's the author of Passing for Perfect, College Imposters, and Other Model Minorities. We've also been speaking with Raina Wu, who is a student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I want to bring Nia Le into the conversation now. He is a clinical social worker and therapist who helps people cope with pressures and questions about their culture and identity. Neil, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'd like to begin by asking how you came to make issues of culture and identity such a big part of your practice.
I growing up in the Midwest, I found that it was something I needed. Going into my own searches for therapists, I didn't see very many Asian American therapists, let alone Asian male therapists. And just finding that connection and that representation just helps with the therapeutic relationship. And it just wasn't present in my searches. And something I'm starting to find is and recognizing is that, especially in Southeast Asian communities, my generation, this like older second generation are the first ones to kind of have this experience of developing a racial identity in America. Our parents were first generation coming over here as refugees, didn't have a lot of that experience. So being able to help process some of that with an understanding I've seen very beneficial for my clients and kind of being able to relate and really understanding that in-between world that I kind of talk about of being this first generation American, but also having a lot of that culture with immigrant parents.
There have been studies, and I mean, as you've been alluding to, that show that as an identity, as a sort of Census Bureau identity, Asian Americans are least likely to seek help for mental illness. A lot of it remains undiagnosed or undetected. What is your best understanding as to why that is?
There's lots of stigma and taboo in speaking about emotions, kind of a lot of saving face in different cultures, kind of very much related to wanting to fit into this model minority identity, wanting to show that we are doing well, that we are not at a loss of anything. And because we get stuck on that identity, we don't want to share. We don't want to seek help because it does admit that things are not quote unquote perfect, right? And it's hard to show that to our families. And I think Dr. Erin had another book about debt, right? And knowing that our parents sacrificed so much for our families to come here, we feel like we can't struggle, right? We compare our struggles to our parents sometimes, right? Which can't be compared to coming over here as refugees, specifically for my family. there is no comparison. So anything I experience here feels like it should be nothing, right? And so seeking out help is just doesn't feel right. And I think more conversations like this, more books like about being feeling perfect is going to help continue to share that and share and normalize some of those stories of seeking help and how that can be beneficial for our community.
So if someone comes to you and says they're feeling this enormous pressure to cope around their educational experience, maybe owing, and it seems like it's owing to their culture or identity, how do you work with students to help them cope with that?
Really helping them find themselves in all of that. We all have different values. We all have different parts. I think I talk to my clients a lot about you have the daughter part, you have the son part, you have the brother part, you have the individual part, you have the student part, or you have the employee part, right? And all those parts deserve a voice. And I think sometimes with our families, one part takes over, which is sometimes that daughter part or the Asian American part. And that overwhelms all the other parts, and we silence those parts, and it's hard for them to find themselves because all their parts are trying to fight against each other. And what I try to do is help them identify those parts and integrate those parts together so that they work together instead of fight one another.
Professor Nin, I want to come back to you now, and I want to talk about this sort of mental health approach to dealing with some of the issues you write about, because I mean, in some ways you can deal with it on a micro level, but as you've said, it's really a cultural issue. What do you think of that? And you know, what is the way to tackle this problem?
Yeah, so that's actually a really important point that I hope the book lands eventually. That, you know, I actually avoid using mental health language in this particular book. Even depression and suicidality, I actually downplay, but I kind of avoid the pathologizing terms for these individuals because it's so easy, you know, to label them as crazy already. Because I'd like to have us try to recognize that what is impelling them to make these irrational and self-harming decisions, right? is cultural, not only in the sense of their families and communities, but also cultural in the sense of US culture and of competition and high stakes testing and et cetera. And also, you know, the racialization of model minority, which is, as we said earlier, you know, a kind of racial role into which Asian Americans step. It's a kind of, you know, a casting call to which Asian Americans answer, right? And so what if the pathology is out there, right? And then driving these kinds of detrimental behaviors.
And yet I'm reminded of the serenity prayer, right? The give me the strength to change the things I can and the wisdom to, and the, you know, people know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to recite the whole thing, but, you know, at one point, it's great if you can do that, but how do you help the individual person who's feeling that stress? It's a tough balance.
Yeah. I think counseling is very useful. These are very young people who are kind of scarce on wisdom at this point in their lives, right? So what they feel are the pressures bearing down, and, you know, for example, the kind of debt language that Nia referred to, and which I'd like to suggest is not just a kind of fact of their lives, that their parents have sacrificed a lot, they owe their parents, but that is weaponized, right? That debt is weaponized and made into a reason for them to have to comply with parental or communal demands, right? And yeah, that they on their own have a very hard time seeing their way out of that kind of paper bag.
Yeah. All right, we need to take another break. If you want to join our conversation, we're going to continue speaking with our guests, Aaron Kuenin from UC Santa Barbara, Raina Wu from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Nia Lay, who is a clinical social worker and therapist. We're going to continue this conversation. Do stay with us. This is The 21st Show. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're revisiting my conversation from earlier this year with Aaron Kuenin, who's an associate professor in the Department of Asian American Studies at UC Santa Barbara and the author of the book Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. It's about a small number of students who go to extreme lengths to perform the role of being good students that they feel their culture and society expects of them. We also spoke with Nia Lay, who's a clinical social worker and therapist. A significant part of his practice involves helping people deal with these societal and cultural pressures. And also Raina Wu, a computer science and philosophy student at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Raina, I wonder, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it, if you can talk about your own, you know, family experience and, you know, how that, you mentioned earlier that maybe you didn't feel quite as much pressure as Professor Nin was describing a little bit earlier before the break.
Yeah, I think that kind of external pressure wasn't as much present in my family. I think my parents have constantly encouraged me to seek help when needed, and you know, it's okay to fail, it's okay to make mistakes. But even with that external validation, internally it's like very easy to invalidate my own feelings. And like, you know, given such great opportunities and like being in a place of privilege, like sometimes it feels like things should be fine, and the academic and social pressures start to take precedence of like what I know is like rationally true and what is being told to me. So I think I know that dynamic is not as common in a lot of Asian American families, but yeah, in my personal experience, there's just a bit of a disconnect between, you know, those external and internal kind of feelings.
All right. At this point, we also got a voicemail that I want to listen to now that's talking about some of these topics. So let's listen to that.
My name is Darren Biscup, and I'm 20 years old. I didn't hear the term like model minority until it came from someone who wasn't Asian. I don't think it's the top concern of a lot of Asians, and yet it's like, I didn't know that was how we were viewed. You know, most of the pressure is probably coming from our own families rather than people who might consider us a model minority. But so yeah, is there pressure to be perfect? I think it has a lot to do with school. Our parents, they view education as such a consistent path to success, or such a stable path to success out of all the other paths that exist. The decision by my mom to like pursue greater education was probably like the best return on investment decision she might have made. So she grew up in Taiwan. She got her undergrad degree in Taiwan, and she was working in Taiwan up till she was like 30. She was doing some kind of like sales type of work, and she decided that she wanted to pivot her entire career in a completely opposite direction. And so she came to the United States and started learning computer science at a CSU. That decision led to her getting a job in computer science, or like as an engineer, and then everything went up from there. I more and more kind of like align with my mom's stance on education, which is kind of funny because back when I was applying to college, there was tons of friction with my mom just on what to study or like what I wanted to get out of college. But yeah, it's totally changed now that I'm actually in college.
All right. Thank you, Darren, for sharing that with us. And Raina, thank you as well. And Professor Nin, let me ask you, though. So though we just heard two perspectives who maybe had, you know, more positive familial or feelings about, you know, their family's orientation toward educational achievement and success. But it's certainly not universal. It's not the subject of what you've been writing about or what you wrote about in your book. So can you talk about a little, let's maybe talk about another individual that you profile, Jennifer Pan.
Yes. So Jennifer grew up in Toronto, Canada, and she was groomed from an early age to be a kind of trophy child. So her parents had her, competing in ice skating with hopes for the Olympics. They also had her in a music conservatory learning piano, and she was performing both to such high levels that, you know, her teachers would say it's rare to see anybody doing this well so young, right? And neither of these were her own choices of pursuit. Neither was the goal of her becoming a pharmacologist. So these were all her father's selections, but she was such a good kid, you know, and she really strove to meet these goals that he had set. And then something went a little bit awry at the end of middle school graduation. I think it's so minor, the amazing thing is how minor this is. She fully expected because her grades seemed to, you know, make it natural that she would become valedictorian, she would get all these awards, neither of which happened. And I think something started to crack in her belief in the system of meritocracy. So beginning in high school, she started to pass, you know, to pretend to still be this perfect child. In the meantime, some of her grades were slipping. By the end of high school, she failed one calculus final, and that one calculus final meant that she did not have all the full credits to get her high school diploma. But instead of being able to tell her parents that she did not have that diploma, needed to take summer school, that was the point where she went big. You know, and pretended everything was fine and started, the charade of attending a college to which her admission had been rescinded.
Wow. Is she the one who ultimately hires somebody to murder her parents?
Yes. Yeah. So they, this went on for like 5 years, all through what would have been undergrad and part of what would have been her pharmacology program. And in the meantime, you know, she did have a secret boyfriend, but she was also living a very conservative lifestyle, really. You know, she had a part-time job in a pizza parlor where she was a really good manager, you know, that kind of thing, or a server, sorry. And then her parents found out that she had in fact been lying to them. They didn't find out about the high school thing, but they did find out that she was not actually in college. And so they clamped down and reasserted a strict curfew, but by now she was in her mid to late 20s. And she tried once again to kind of get back on track, and she also tried to kill herself, I think, a couple times, but neither of those courses worked. And so in her mind, the calculation, you know, like she could not see an option where she just rebelled or simply flat out disappointed them and still managed to live a happy life. And so in her calculus, it was somehow better. If her parents could die with the whatever illusion was left, you know, of their daughter being able to meet their expectations, right? Wow. And then she would be free. But only under those circumstances could she imagine being free.
Neil A., you've been listening to this. I wonder what your response is. You know, what are you thinking when you hear that story?
It just saddens me to know that, like, I think the myth part of the model minority, kind of like you were all alluding to earlier, is that there is no end to it, right? It's something that it's not something that we can, the myth portion is like nothing that we can't achieve. And it's oftentimes I see with clients that it is a kind of a human experience, right? To feel less than, to feel inadequate, to feel not enough. And unfortunately for with the model minority, it's just, there's a clear source to what makes some of us feel this way. And helping clients to feel enough, to feel themselves, or in kind of the micro lens, hopefully can help one individual to feel that they don't need to hide some of that stuff, that they can be themselves and not resort to some extreme measures sometimes.
And can you talk a little bit, as what we were talking about before the break, about, you know, the idea of helping individuals, but then this really also in some ways shouldn't be on the individual, right? It should be more broadly through the culture or the society, something that we address. Where do you come down on that balance?
Well, as a micro practitioner, I'm very on the one-on-one lens. Definitely there's lots of things systemically that need to happen to help with the micro, right? Access to care, destigmatizing care, quality, increasing quality of care. But for me to speak more on the micro, because that's where my experience is helping clients to find and define themselves a little bit more, and including the values of society, right? It's not to say that we don't have some of the same values as society, as our cultures, but to help us find that balance, to find that integration that makes sense for us. And that's going to be very different for every individual, and helping them find that point so they can feel at peace in their own bodies, in their own minds, in their own hearts. And whatever proportions that is, that includes some of these external and internal things.
All right, Neil A., I know you need to run before the end of the hour, so I want to thank you so much for being with us. He's a clinical social worker and therapist who helps people cope with these pressures around their culture and identity. Thank you for joining us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Nin, I want to come back to you as we're approaching the end of our conversation. And as we talked about earlier, and I think it bears repeating, you intentionally chose these cases because in some ways they're very extreme and interesting, frankly, representations. You wrote your book wanting it to be accessible to students. What do you hope that young people take away from it?
Well, both the sense that, you know, how devastating this path they're on can end up being, but also a kind of corollary of that is a sense of recognition that these cases, these outlier cases, are actually not that different from our own motivations as second generation Asian Americans, trying to please everyone in our lives, right, on the macro and the micro level. So these are cautionary tales that I'm presenting, and also I'm hoping to allow readers to take some pause, and imagine alternatives to what seem to be, a path of no felt options. You either succeed, or the alternative to success is just annihilation, right? It is not fathomable, to live with failure. And I am hoping very hard that the book helps people to reframe that for themselves.
Erin Kuei-Nin is associate professor at UC Santa Barbara and the author of the book, Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st
Show. Thank you so much for having me.
Raina Wu, we've also been speaking with, is a student in computer science and philosophy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Raina, thank you for coming in and sharing your own personal experience as well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all the time we have for our show today. Again, if you're interested in looking up the book, it's called Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. It's by Aaron Kue Nin. We'll have a link to that at our website, 21stshow.org. Before we go, I want to say a fond farewell to producer Erica Scalise. She's trading in her producer hat with us to become a reporter covering commercial real estate news in Chicago for the news outlet Biz Now. Erica has been our engagement producer, which means she's the person members of our texting group hear from most often. She's also produced many great conversations on the show on everything from COVID-19 to abortion to our interview with a social media star known as the Korean Vegan. Erica, we will miss you, but we are excited for your new opportunity. Best of luck. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.